Thank you very much. So I'll let you know right away that I will not ever say yes or no to the answer of this question. So the suspense is gone. So a question that I think a lot of people in this workshop are interested in is, can we derive the standard model or something close to the standard model from some reasonable principles? And so, of course, the internal degrees of freedom in the standard model, the hypercharge, isospin, and color, are described by algebras of observables that are connected to representations of this standard model gauge group, which I like to call S of U2 times U3. So remember, that's the 5 by 5 unitary matrices with determinant one that are in this block form of a 2 by 2 block and a 3 by 3 block. So the big question, one big question then becomes, why in the world should this particular group be favored and the particular representations that we see? So there has been quite a bit of work on this kind of thing. And in particular, for example, Alan Cohn and his collaborators have tried to answer it using non-commutative geometry. They've actually given a number of different answers, different papers attempting to do this, where they think of space-time as having the usual manifold description in the horizontal directions, you might call them, but then a non-commutative description in terms of a finite-dimensional non-commutative algebra in the vertical or fiber or internal directions. So I'm going to present something much more tentative than their work. Certainly not a theory of physics. It's really a review of some work by Todorov and Dubois-Violette and a bit of Kirill Krasnov's work. And these involve Octonions and Jordan algebras. So I like Jordan algebras because they're a very conceptually clear framework for dealing with observables in quantum physics. And I'll explain them. I think they're often thought of as being a little bit weird, but I'd like to try to explain them in a way that makes them seem very natural. In the classification of Jordan algebras of a certain kind, one discovers the exceptional Jordan algebra consisting of 3 by 3 self-adjoint Octonionic matrices. This is sort of different than all the other ones. You could think of it in modern language, in fashionable language, as the algebra of observables of an Octonionic Q-trit. So there's been a lot of talk these days about whether physics could somehow be explained in terms of quantum information theory. I guess this goes back all the way to John Wheeler's idea of it from bit, but more recently, with the interest in quantum computation, people are trying to come up with ideas for how to get physics to arise naturally out of qubits. But you could also have Q-trits, where the Hilbert space is not C2, but C3. And you could also replace the complex numbers by other number systems. And so that gives you the idea of an Octonionic Q-trit in a rough form. And so I'm going to explain some ideas of Michel Dubois-Violette and Ivan Todorov, and we'll see the following purely mathematical result, that the true gauge group of the standard model, this group S of U2 times U3, consists of the symmetries of an Octonionic Q-trit that have two special properties. First, they preserve all the structure that arises from a choice of a unit imaginary Octonion, which I'll call I in the Octonions. So that picks out a copy of the complex numbers in the Octonions. And second of all, they restrict to give symmetries of an Octonionic qubit, which you can think of as sort of sitting inside the Octonionic Q-trit. So I don't know really what this means. I've been thinking about this, trying to understand what it means, but it's appealing to me because we're getting the gauge group of the standard model from some ideas that that have some resonance with ideas from the foundations of quantum physics. And I'll explain this. So let's just start at the beginning here though, and think about observables in quantum mechanics. So in the most common approach to finite dimensional quantum systems, you take observables to be self-adjoint complex matrices. So elements of what I'll call HNC, and by N permission complex matrices. And what can you do with those things mathematically? Well, you can take real linear combinations of them. The big thing you can't do with them is multiply them in the usual way, because the product of self-adjoint matrices isn't self-adjoint. However, what you can do is you can square a self-adjoint matrix and get a self-adjoint matrix. And this has a very nice physical meaning. So it means that if you take two different non-commuting observables, there's no reason to expect there to be any well-defined observable that's the product of those two. For example, position times momentum in another situation is not an observable in quantum mechanics, but you can always square an observable and get an observable. However, once you know that you can square observables and also take real linear combinations of them, then you can define a kind of funny product of observables called the Jordan product, which is just one half of a plus b squared minus a squared minus b squared. And in the particular, and in this, if you work out what that is in the case of these n by n Hermitian matrices, it's just one half of ab plus ba. So it's a kind of symmetrized product. So this product has peculiar properties compared to other forms of algebra. So it's commutative, obviously, but it's not associative. But it is, however, power associative, meaning that if you take a product of a bunch of copies of the same observable, you can parenthesize it in any manner, and you always get the same answer. That power associativity has a good physical significance. It means that not only can you square an observable and get a well-defined observable, you could also cube it or raise it to the fourth power and get an unambiguously defined observable. And so that's something that I think we can say is a reasonable thing you might want just from conceptual reasons. If you're in a world where measuring one observable may mess up the measurement of another, then you have to be very careful about multiplying them, but raising a single one to a power, you could measure that just by measuring your original observable and then raising the answer, the experimental answer to that power. So that's a nice thing to have. And so Jordan and Wigner and von Neumann turned these ideas into a definition of a mathematical structure. Now the good Jordan algebras are the ones called the Euclidean Jordan algebras, or sometimes formally real Jordan algebras. There are other Jordan algebras, but as far as I'm concerned, they're sort of a mess compared to these in terms of understanding what's really going on with them. So because the definition here of an Euclidean Jordan algebra is pretty nice and conceptual. So it's a real vector space with a bilinear, commutative, and power associative product that has one additional property, which says that if the sum of the squares of a bunch of elements is zero, then every one of them has to be zero. And all of these properties here are more or less justifiable. You can make a good argument for them, starting from our concept of observable in quantum physics. In particular, the last property is a way of saying that the observables should be thought of as real valued things that you measure and get a real number as your answer. And so if you measure a bunch of quantities that are squares and they add up to zero, well, if they're real valued quantities, then they all have to be real. So this is a beautiful definition. There's a general definition of Jordan algebra, which involves some bizarre looking identity, which I don't want to even write down. That bizarre looking identity, which I'm not going to even talk about, it follows from this stuff. So in the special case of a Euclidean Jordan algebra, we don't even need to talk about that identity until we want to start getting technical. I'm mentioning that just because you may have seen the general definition of a Jordan algebra and wondered what happened to that funny looking identity in my treatment. So starting from this Jordan, von Neumann and Wigner proved that a classification of finite dimensional Euclidean Jordan algebras, and they showed that they're all isomorphic to a direct sum of ones like this. There's a little list of them. So you can take the n by n self-adjoint real matrices with the Jordan product of the form that I already wrote down. You can do it for the complex matrices, which is the motivating example. You can do it for the quaternionic matrices, and you can do it for the octonionic matrices. However, only n by n self-adjoint octonionic matrices where n is less than or equal to 3 actually give you Jordan algebras. And so the case n equals 3 is the most unusual one. That's the exceptional Jordan algebra. And I believe that was discovered in this classification theorem, although the mathematician Adrian Albert started thinking about that algebra at about the same time. And sometimes it's called the Albert algebra. I hear from some people that these three gentlemen here discovered the exceptional Jordan algebra. I'd like to know the answer to that, but that doesn't really matter. Finally, there's another infinite family of Euclidean Jordan algebras, which are called spin factors sometimes. So these are of the form R direct sum Rn, where the first copy of R contains the multiplicative unit. There's an identity element in this Jordan algebra. But the formula for the multiplication is as shown below here. So I'm suggestively writing the elements as T and X arrow to make you think of space-time. And the multiplication works like this, that if you take the dot product of two of the spatial elements, you get a number, and that goes into the time part. And then this is the vector times the scalar here, and this is just the product of two scalars. So it's basically built up out of the operations that you can do when you have a vector space with a dot product. So that's also a somewhat mysterious class of Jordan algebras compared to these ones which look like the matrix algebras that we're familiar with in the study of finite dimensional quantum systems. So what about these spin factors? What's going on with these spin factors? Well, I'll tell you a few results about Jordan algebras without attempting to prove them. So one nice fact, this is fairly obvious here. There's other results that'll be a little less obvious. That every Euclidean Jordan algebra, let's call it J, it automatically comes with a cone of what we could call non-negative elements, which are the sums of squares. So I've already sort of shown from the definition, if you think about it a bit, that this is a cone, meaning that if you add two elements of J plus, you get another element of J plus. And if you multiply an element of J plus by a positive number, you get an element of J plus. So in the matrix examples, these would be the non-negative Hermitian matrices, the ones with non-negative eigenvalues, say in the complex case. But for the spin factor, this cone is isomorphic to the future cone in n plus one dimensional Minkowski spacetime. So there's some funny similarity between the spin factors and spacetimes. Also,
isomorphic as what?
So there's a concept of a vector space with a cone and a map, linear map between vector spaces mapping one cone to another cone.
Oh, so just isomorphic as cones in vector spaces.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yes. So every Euclidean Jordan algebra comes with a cone. Usually, most of these cones are not isomorphic to the cones you're familiar with from Minkowski spacetime. But for the spin factors, they are exactly those.
Yes, John, if I wanted to get the backward pointing ones, would that be very hard?
No, you would just take the negative of the elements of J plus. Okay. So that, you should imagine that as also being there. So just the take taking minus all the elements in J plus, and you get this other cone that we could call J minus if you wanted. So yeah, they're all there. Then another fact that's a little less obvious is that, well, quite a bit less obvious, is that every Euclidean Jordan algebra automatically gets a function on it. That is, you can just cook it up without making any arbitrary choices, which we call the determinant that takes values in the real numbers, which vanishes on the boundary of J plus. In the case of these Jordan algebras that are matrices, like self-adjoint real or complex or matrices, the determinant is just the usual determinant of a matrix. And so that's why we call it determinant. But for the spin factor, this determinant function is the Minkowski metric. That is, it's t squared minus x dot x. So this is another way in which the spin factors sort of look like Minkowski spacetimes. Well, they look exactly like Minkowski spacetimes. So there's something funny going on here, which I've pondered for a long time, and so have a lot of you out there, which is that spin factors aren't only algebras of observables. It's a little bit tendentious to say this, but I'll say it anyway. They're also Minkowski spacetimes. Now, the Jordan algebras of 2x2 self-adjoint matrices are especially interesting because those turn out to be isomorphic to spin factors. So in this classification of Jordan algebras that I wrote down, there's a bit of overlap or redundancy that these four cases here, 2x2 self-adjoint matrices valued in R, C, H, or O, those are isomorphic to Minkowski. Those are isomorphic to the spin factors shown here, which you can imagine as being incarnations of 3, 4, 6, and 10 dimensional Minkowski spacetime. This coincidence has launched 1,000 ships. It's very important, for example, in why supersymmetric theories work very beautifully in these particular dimensions. But I'm not going to go in that direction here. I just want to point out the basic idea, which is that if you take the determinant of a 2x2 matrix, that will be the determinant function that I've been talking about in these four cases here. And the determinant of a 2x2 matrix really just is a Minkowski metric, which becomes clear if you write down the matrix entries in this kind of way. So the diagonal entries of a Hermitian matrix are real. So T and X here are real. And the off diagonal entry here is just any old entry in our division algebra, R, C, H, or O. But that's a normed algebra. And so that element times its, and it has a kind of star operation. And so that element times its star is the norm squared. That's hinting at why we have this these isomorphisms. That's not the proof of the isomorphism of Jordan algebras, but that's the basic clue there as to what's going on. Whereas when we get to 3x3 matrices, the determinant is a cubic function and so on. So we'd get light cones described by cubic equations in that case and so on. So what's going on here though? This is all sort of rather mysterious because we started out trying to formalize the concept of an algebra of observables using some very elegant, clean axioms. And then these three geniuses figured out how to classify them all. But then all of a sudden we've gotten hurled into the world of these Minkowski spacetimes, which wasn't what we were trying to talk about at all. So something strange is going on here. This is my best attempt to understand that so far. Excuse me. So one thing is that a Euclidean Jordan algebra doesn't just describe observables, it also describes states. So it turns out that any Euclidean Jordan algebra automatically comes with another function besides the determinant, it comes with a trace. So there's another real valued function on your Jordan algebra. That's a linear functional, actually. And for the case of matrices, the case of Euclidean Jordan algebras of matrices, it's just the usual trace. And an element in this positive cone or non-negative cone with trace equals one is a state. So that should remind you of a density matrix in quantum mechanics. And indeed, a density matrix would be a special case of this idea. So we're just generalizing that. And so in particular, given a state S and an observable A, we can define the expected value of the observable A in the state S. And we define it to be the trace of S times A, where we use the Jordan product. So this is, again, supposed to be familiar. If you've studied enough quantum mechanics, this is just the way that you take a so-called density matrix and an observable and calculate the expected value of the observable in that using that density matrix. And finally, there are certain special elements in a Jordan algebra that are called projections, who are just elements whose squares themselves. And if you have a projection whose trace is equal to one, that turns out to be a special kind of state. You can check that it's going to be a non-negative element because it's the square of something, namely itself, and its trace is one, so it's a state. But these are some special states, and these are called the pure states. So all this stuff is very familiar in the case of the n by n complex matrices, where the states are the density matrices, and any vector, unit vector in a Hilbert space gives you a projection onto that vector, which gives you a pure state. So the whole formalism of quantum mechanics, not just the observables, but also the states and pure states, can be done starting with the Euclidean Jordan algebra. So that's why it's a nice formalism for doing physics. Now, if you work out what the space of pure states is, for the matrix algebra cases, it's more or less familiar. Where we are, I hope, used to the idea that the space of pure states for a complex quantum system is complex projective space. So you take C to the N, you take the unit vectors, and then you identify two unit vectors if they differ just by a phase. And so you get CPN minus one as the space of pure states. But you can also think of that as the space of projections, projection operators in here. With trace one, projections onto one-dimensional subspaces. So that works the same way in all these three cases. And it also works even in the Octonionic case, although that's the tricky case. But you can ask, okay, that's all fine and dandy, but what is the space of pure states for one of our spin factors? The goal here is to try to like understand the spin factors. Well, there it turns out, you can just work it out that the space of pure states is a sphere. It's Sn minus one. We can actually draw this whole story very accurately in the case of the spin factor where n equals two, because then the spin factor is just a three-dimensional space and we can actually draw what's going on. And so so it looks like this. The forwards cone is just a usual cone in three dimensions. The surface where the trace is equal to one is a horizontal plane. And so if we intersect those two, we get this gray disk here, and those will be the states of our Jordan algebra. And then the pure states turn out to be the ones on the boundary. In fact, that's always true that the pure states form the boundary of the space. Well, they form the extreme points, sorry, not the whole boundary, but just the so-called extreme points of the set of states. But here it's the whole boundary. It's this one sphere, in this case, a circle. The surface with the determinant equals zero is what you'd call the light cone, both the forwards and the backwards light cone. So we're seeing that the concepts which have one meaning in terms of space-time geometry, like forwards light cone, interior of the light cone and so on, all those geometrical concepts familiar from Minkowski space-time have analogs where we think of them in terms of quantum systems. I mean, they have other descriptions is what I mean, where we think of them as quantum concepts. Now, what's nice about all this is that we have one way of thinking about states in these matrix cases and a different way of thinking about states in the spin factor cases. But I said that in certain examples, the spin factors are also algebras of matrices. And so then we get a nice matchup of the two ways of thinking of things, namely what in the 2x2 matrix cases, the space of states on the one hand, it's a projective line, RP1, CP1, HP1, or OP1. But on the other hand, because this set of pure states and the spin factor is a sphere, you also get a sphere. So you get a 1-sphere, a 2-sphere, a 4-sphere, and an 8-sphere. A lot of people who study math or physics are well familiar with the fact that the Riemann sphere, CP1, is also a 2-sphere, but it has these analogs in these four cases. And so, of course, these are also the Jordan algebras that we would say are the observables for a qubit. I mean, we're most familiar with complex qubits, and then CP1 is the space of states of a complex qubit, but we can talk about real complex quaternionic or octonionic qubits. And those qubits, those pairs of, well, if we think of it in terms of a Hilbert space approach, they'd be pairs of real numbers, pairs of complex numbers, pairs of quaternions, pairs of octonions. Those also turn out to be the spinners, the left-handed or right-handed spinners in the space-times of these various dimensions. So there's something nice going on in these cases. Now, there's something that I've left out, which is sort of necessary if you really want to do physics, at least the way that we're accustomed to doing it. In ordinary physics, we have Noether's theorems saying that observables should generate symmetries. And it turns out that wanting that to be true, complex case as special, because the only Euclidean Jordan algebras, of all the Euclidean Jordan algebras on my list, only the n-by-n complex Hermitian matrices can also be made into a Lie algebra. So you want your observables to generate symmetries, so they should form the Lie algebra of some Lie group. And only in this case can you do that if you want the Lie algebra to act in a non-trivial way, non-zero way, as derivations of the Jordan product. So in the case of the complex matrices, you can define a new Lie bracket, which I'm going to write as a Poisson bracket here, but it's a Lie bracket, and it's I times the commutator. So, right, the commutator of self-adjoint matrices is not self-adjoint, but when you multiply it by I, it becomes self-adjoint. So then you get this Lie bracket structure on your observables, and it has this nice property, which says that bracketing with A acts like a derivative, it obeys a kind of product rule. So that's what we use all the time in quantum mechanics, where we let observables generate symmetries. And if you look at Schrodinger's equation, or sorry, the Heisenberg formulation of quantum mechanics, that I shows up there, as well as the commutator. So it turns out that you cannot get this mathematics to work in any way for the cases of the real or the quaternionic matrix cases. And I wrote a paper about this and some reflections on that. But one interesting thing is that those real and quaternionic cases actually do still play a role in ordinary quantum mechanics, but they have to be sort of fit inside the complex picture to actually work. So there are some group representations that are said to be real, even though they're complex representations, they come from a real representation. And there's some that are called quaternionic, which come from a quaternionic representation. And those kinds of representations play a special role in quantum mechanics. So I argue in this other paper here that all three division algebras actually are visible in ordinary quantum mechanics. But with H and C playing a kind of starring role, because I believe of this fact that only in that context can you get observables to generate symmetries.
So question, John.
Sure.
So it seems like in all examples, in addition, like you're talking about the Jordan algebra of self-adjoint operators, but you do know what are the skew adjoint operators.
Well, I know. Yes.
I mean, like over any of these base rings, are they somehow, like, you know, I know what a skew adjoint real matrix is. I know it,
Yes. Okay. Yeah, sure.
You have those Lie algebras lying around.
Yeah, there are those Lie algebras lying around, and those are, and so if you are willing to work in a framework where the symmetry generators are those skew adjoint guys, and the observables are the self-adjoint guys, and you work with both of them, then you're fine. Yeah, so that's fine.
Okay.
So basically you would just have to accept, to do those kind of quantum mechanics, you would have to accept the idea that symmetry generators and observables are different, fundamentally different kinds of things. Whereas in the complex case, you can turn one to the other automatically by multiplying or dividing by I. And so, I can't boss God around. So if God had wanted to use real quantum mechanics, then she would have just accepted that observables and symmetry generators are going to be different. But anyway, I'm trying to make an argument that there's something specially nice about the complex case. And physicists, for example, will say, like, if you want to know how time evolution works, you write down the Hamiltonian, right? So that's saying that, like, you tell me the observable, I'll tell you the symmetry it generates. So that would not work in these other worlds of described by the other division algebras.
And in the Octonian case, do you have enough associativity to get the Lie algebra to work, or?
There is a Lie algebra. There is a Lie algebra of derivations of your Jordan algebra in every case, and so you can use that Lie algebra as your symmetry generators. Yeah, that's right. And I'll probably for the exceptional Jordan algebra case, that Lie algebra would be the Lie algebra of the group F4.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Looks like you have a question, Lee, or a comment.
Yes. You were talking about this sphere S2 and the action of SL2C on it. And if I understand you right, there's an analogous sphere made from Octonians, but is there an action of SL2 Octonian on it?
Yes, there is. If you can figure out what the heck SL2 Octonians is, so you can't take SL2 Octonians too literally, because 2x2 matrices of Octonians don't form a group. The multiplication is not associative, but there's a group that everyone who's thought about it has agreed should be called SL2 Octonians. And it turns out that it is the group, it is the group spin 9-1. So it's the double cover of SO 9-1.
Okay, and an axon, it's basically the eighth sphere.
Yeah, that's right. So if you're in 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, Lorentz transformations form this group you're calling SL2O, and it acts as conformal transformations of your field of view, which would be an eighth sphere.
Very good.
And so it's all very much like that.
Has anybody ever written down a conformal field theory that had those symmetries?
I don't know. there would be people here in the audience who'd be much more likely to know, I think. So I don't know.
Thank you.
Uh-huh, sure. It sounds like something some string theorist should have tried, right? Because this is the space-time that string theory lives in very, very nicely. Okay, so I'll march on. So what about H2O and H3O? So these I haven't gotten into in great detail, although we are just starting to talk about them. So amazingly, these Jordan algebras are actually connected mathematically, at least, to the standard model. So there are three papers here by Michelle and Yvonne that discuss this issue. And I just want to summarize them and maybe try to isolate some of the nice mathematical ideas in these papers. So remember from my last talk, if you can, that choosing a unit imaginary Actonian, which I'll call I, gives a way of including the complex numbers into the Actonians. And thus, because the Actonians have an inner product on them, it lets you split the Actonians into a direct sum of vector spaces, one of which you can identify with complex numbers, and the other I'll just call C perp, which will be a six-dimensional space. Also, it puts a complex structure on C perp coming from left multiplication by I. So left multiplication by I makes the Actonians into a complex vector space, and it splits into a copy of C and then a this six-dimensional real space, which becomes now a three-dimensional complex space. So that same kind of trick works for the self-adjoint matrices. So if we take the 2x2 self-adjoint matrices of the complex numbers, it now gets included into the 2x2 Actonianic self-adjoint matrices, just because we're thinking of complex numbers as special Actonians. And then we get, because there's an inner product on H2O coming from this trace that it has, it lets us split H2O into H2C and a copy of C perp. And so this, I've shown how to identify with 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, this one with 4-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, and this is 6-dimensional in the real sense, a 6-dimensional real vector space, or if you like, a 3-dimensional complex vector space. So we get all this from choosing a unit imaginary Actonian. Now, part of the funny business that's going on is that H2O has naturally the structure of both the 10-dimensional Minkowski spacetime, which comes from this, the fact that the determinant is the Minkowski metric, but it also has a 10-dimensional Euclidean space. It has a Euclidean inner product, which you get using the Jordan product and then taking the trace. So if you work out what this is, you get the same kind of expression.
John, sorry to interrupt you.
Sure.
Sorry to interrupt you. Could we just go back to the previous slide, if you don't mind? The last equation.
Yeah.
Does this have an interpretation in terms of SL2O being writable as, say, SL2C and SL2H?
Not SL2. I don't know how to do that. I mean, this definitely says that SL2C is a subgroup of SL2O, and then the but I don't know how to write SL2O in terms of SL2C and SL2H. Yeah, that doesn't.
It's okay. We can talk later. Thank you.
So I was saying that when you have a Jordan algebra, it naturally gets, just from its Jordan multiplication, it naturally gets a determinant and a trace. And so if we use both of those, H2O naturally gets the structure of both a Minkowskian metric and a Euclidean metric, both invariant under all transformations that preserves the multiplication. So the automorphism group of the Jordan algebra, the things that preserve the Jordan product, has to also preserve both of these kinds of metrics. And so it must be contained both in 091 and also in 010. So it must be contained in 09. And in fact, it turns out that it's exactly equal to 09. So this sort of shed some light. On the Euclidean or Minkowskian puzzle that I was posing last time about, should we think of the standard model gauge group as sitting inside SO10 or SO91? And the answer was that it's in both. But this is sort of meant to give some new look on that. It's much easier to see, actually, that the automorphism group of H2O is just exactly 09, because you just use the fact that it's isomorphic to the spin factor. And the spin factor, the multiplication on it only depends on The only interesting part about it is the dot product on R9. So anything in O9 will be an automorphism of this Jordan algebra. Now, we can already see one kind of way then to get the standard model gauge group into the game here. So if we go and work not with O9, but with the double cover of its connected component. So you may wonder why I'm doing this, and I'll get back to it, but that will be spin 9. So let's switch from working with O9 to spin 9 for reasons that aren't terribly well motivated yet, but certainly common in physics to do that. So the sub of spin 9 that preserves, so spin 9 will act on H2O, and the subgroup that preserves the H2C will be, one can check, just spin 3 times spin 6, or actually that's sort of double counting the double covers. So it's really that mod Z mod 2. So basically what's going on here is that the subgroup of spin 9 that preserves H2 of C will act on 9-dimensional space, but it will act on it in a way that preserves a split of 9-dimensional space into 3 dimensions, which are the ones coming from this 4-dimensional space-time and the 6 remaining spatial dimensions. So that's why, that's intuitively why we get spin 3 times spin 6 showing up. But there's some nice Lie group coincidences that say that you can also think of that as SU2 times SU4. And as we saw last time, this group here contains a copy of the gauge group of the standard model. Let me just remind you a bit how that goes. So we can sort of take the Pati-Salam model and strip off one of the SU2 Pati-Salam model and actually map U1 times SU2 times SU3 into SU2 times SU4. In the following fashion, which I discussed in more detail last time, and it's not quite 1-to-1, but it's just 3-to-1. And so then if you take this group here and you mod out by Z mod 2, which is what we have to do up here, then you get actually a 6-to-1 homomorphism from U1 times SU2 times SU3 into SU2 times SU4 mod Z mod over Z mod 2. And you can show that the kernel of this homomorphism is exactly that 6-element subgroup of this group that acts trivially on all these standard model fermions, or all the standard model particles. So we get an inclusion of that quotient group into SU2 times SU2 mod Z mod 2. And this quotient here is exactly the true, what I'm calling the true gauge group of the standard model. So that's how this group contains the standard model gauge group. I mean, that's a way that it contains the standard model gauge group. That's the most physically relevant way. So what we draw from this is that the standard model gauge group acts as automorphisms of the Jordan algebra H2O that preserve the subalgebra H2C. And if you want to sell this in the popular press, you should say it like this. The true gauge group of the standard model acts as symmetries of an octonionic qubit, and it preserves the subalgebra of observables of a complex qubit. I mean, that's perfectly true. It sounds flashy, but it's perfectly true if what we mean by octonionic qubit is the algebra of observables, which is this Jordan algebra, H2O, and similarly here, H2O. So this sounds nice. I don't know what it means, but it sounds nice. But if you think about it a little bit more, although it sounds impressive, it leaves open two really big questions. There's some slack in this description. First of all, the automorphism group of H2O is actually O9. And for some unmotivated reason, I switched to working with spin 9, the double cover of its connected component. So why should we be using spin 9? Second of all, although this sentence is true, in fact, the standard model gauge group is not all of the automorphisms of H2O that preserve H2C. There's this larger group that does that. So then the question is, what makes the smaller group, the standard model gauge group, special? So we haven't really characterized the standard model gauge group by means of these sentences here. So we can tackle these questions and answer these questions. And the interesting thing is that to answer them, we need to bring in the exceptional Jordan algebra H3O. I mean, I don't know if we need to, I shouldn't be so bold, that's what I'll do. So as I mentioned, that's the Jordan algebra of observables of an Actonionic Q-trit, or more concretely, it's just these 3x3 matrices, the diagonal elements are real. This has a larger automorphism group. It's a 52-dimensional group. It's called F4. We won't need to know too much about it. Well, we will to prove all the things I'm going to say, but I won't prove them. So one interesting thing about it is that F4 can't act on O3. So although you might think of F4 as the symmetries of an Actonionic Q-trit, and you might have thought that an Actonionic Q-trit should have something to do with O3, that's not a representation of F4 in any non-trivial way, because the smallest representation of F4 is bigger than the dimension of O3. This is 24-dimensional. The smallest non-trivial rep is 26-dimensional. So there's no Hilbert space picture of the Actonionic Q-trit, at least not a complete picture. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to pick a copy of H2O sitting inside H3O as a Jordan subalgebra. You could do this in any way, but just for explicitness, I'll pick it as this 2x2 matrices sitting inside the 3x3 matrices. So there will be a subgroup of the automorphisms of H3O that preserve that copy of H2O. And that turns out to be spin 9. So this answers question A, which is why are we working with spin 9 instead of O9? So the proposed answer here is don't work with automorphisms of H2O, because that's the group O9. Instead, work with automorphisms of H3O that happen to map H2O to itself. So they will give automorphisms of H2O, but they'll also be messing around on doing things with H3O. And it turns out that these form the group spin 9. Okay, so the idea is we're led to this idea of thinking about H2O and H3O together, with H2O sitting inside H3O. And I'm just gonna pick a specific way of having it sit inside there.
So just a quick question. So is it correct to say that you can have H2O inside H3O in three different ways?
Oh, you can have it inside it infinitely many different ways. They're not all the ways are so beautifully described as like block matrices. Yeah, there are three very nice ways in terms of matrices, but there's actually a continuum of ways, because there are these, you can act by automorphisms and rotate, so to speak, into all sorts of different ways. Yeah.
I should not start thinking of three fermion generations in H3O and each 2x2 being one generation.
You're welcome to try, and lots of people have, and none of them has ever reported back any success with that idea. So I don't know. I don't recommend it too much, but it would be really cool if something like that worked. But I can't get it to work yet. So why do we get spin 9 when we do this trick? Well, one way to see it is that you can think of H3O as split up into this way. So here's our H2O, and this is a pair of Actonians here. So we get a copy of O squared, and then here's a lonely real number here, alpha. So as representations of spin 9, H3O actually breaks up into this into these three representations. And so the way it works is that spin 9 is acting on R trivially. So you should think of this as a scalar. It acts on O2 via the real spinner representation. So you should think of O2 as a spinner for spin 9. And it acts on H2O as we already mentioned. You can think of H2O either as 9 plus 1 dimensional space-time or 10 dimensional space, and the rotations or the double cover of the rotations are acting on that. And then the Jordan product on H2O, by the way, can be described using invariant operations on these scalars, spinners, and vectors. And you can check then that only spin 9 preserves all those operations. And so spin 9 is the subgroup of automorphisms of H3O that preserve H2O. So that's the idea. But the nice thing about it is we're seeing this nice scalar vector spinner thing going on here. So now we're ready to answer question B, which is what picks out the standard model gauge group as a subgroup of spin 9? So here's one way to get at it. So first, choose a copy of H2O and H3O, which I've done. The subgroup of F4 that preserves that is spin 9. Then next, pick a unit imaginary octonion. So it turns out that the subgroup of F4 that preserves all the structure that puts on H3O, I'll maybe be more explicit about that in a minute, is SU3 times SU3 modulo the diagonal Z mod 3. And then finally, the subgroup of F4 that preserves all this structure, that is both the copy of H2O and all the structure that this imaginary octonion puts on H3O, is exactly the true gauge group of the standard model. It's a subgroup of this, of SU3 times SU3 over Z mod 3. And it's also a subgroup of this spin 9 that I've mentioned here. So this is something I'd like to quickly sketch an argument for. I'm getting low on time here. But first, let me just sort of say the bumper sticker version of this yet again, which is that the true gauge group of the standard model consists of precisely the symmetries of an octonionic Q-trit that preserve all the structure arising from a choice of a unit imaginary octonion on the one hand, and two, restrict symmetries of an octonionic qubit on the other hand. So again, I don't know what this means, but you could imagine that if nature were trying to fundamentally be working with octonionic Q-trits and yet still get the benefit of working with complex qubits, that it might want to use this type of mathematics. Let me show you a little bit more about how those results are obtained. This is all review of work in Todorov and Dubois Violette's paper, by the way. So if you pick a unit imaginary octonion, you get an inclusion of the complex numbers in the octonion. So you get an inclusion of H3C and H3O, and you again can split up H3O in this way in terms of H3C in an orthogonal space, which is just the space of guys whose inner product with guys in H3 of C is zero. But if you work out concretely what it is, it's just these off diagonal matrices whose off diagonal entries are just living in C perp. And this space here gets a complex structure via left multiplication by I. So we not only get this splitting, but we also get that this complementary space becomes a complex vector space in a natural way. And so then there's a theorem which says that for any choice of a unit imaginary octonion, the subgroup of F4, that is the automorphisms of H3O, that preserve this splitting and also preserve the complex structure on this orthogonal space is SU3 times SU3 mod Z mod 3. And most of the work in showing this is in Ichiro Yokota's very nice paper on exceptional Lie groups. But just to give you like a little hint of what's going on, I'll tell you how SU3 times SU3 mod Z3 acts on H3O. I'm sort of probably running out of time here, but you can think of this complementary space as a space of 3 by 3 complex matrices. And so you can think of H3O as split up into self-adjoint 3x3 matrices plus arbitrary complex 3x3 matrices. So you can think of it, any element of H3O as a pair of a self-adjoint matrix and a complex and an arbitrary matrix. And then a guy in SU3 times SU3 acts on this pair in the following way, where the first copy of SU3 conjugates your self-adjoint matrix, and it multiplies on the right, roughly speaking, on the other matrix. And the other element of SU3 acts only on the second matrix. And so that's how it works. And the important thing, I guess, to realize is that the two copies of SU3 that are showing up in this game are acting in very different ways. They have very different meanings, these two SU3s. So when we go all the way down to look at the standard model gauge group as a subgroup of this, we'll see that the second SU3 becomes the strong force SU3, and it's acting separately on each one of these matrices. Sorry, it's on each entry of this matrix, which is an octonion. And it acts as octonion automorphisms that preserve an imaginary octonion. Whereas the first acts to mix up the different matrix entries. And this winds up becoming the electroweak group. That is, a subgroup of it winds up being the electroweak group. And it's only that subgroup that preserves the splitting of the 3x3 matrix into a 1x1 and a 2x2 part. So that's supposed to make it roughly intuitive about how this SU3 gets broken down into a U1 times SU2. It's because it does so when you demand that we're looking at transformations that preserve this copy of H2O sitting inside H3O. I know I'm going through this a little bit too fast to absorb, but my notes will be available. And lots of links to papers on this stuff. So basically the upshot stated, which I stated before, but I'll state it a little more precisely now. So if you pick a unit imaginary octonion, you get a Jordan subalgebra, H3 of C sitting inside H3 of O. But then if you also choose a Jordan subalgebra, H2 of O sitting inside H3 of O, then you are ready to get the standard model gauge group, because the group of automorphisms of H3O that preserves the splitting that we get and also the complex structure that we get on the complementary space, and also this Jordan subalgebra H2 of O, is isomorphic to the true gauge group of the standard model. So that's a bit of a mouthful, but that's the most precise statement I'm going to give you of this result. If that's too precise, you can read the summary here. So now I'm in the home stretch. So the summary version is what I've said before. I'll just say it again, that the true gauge group of the standard model consists of the automorphisms of the exceptional Jordan algebra to preserve all the structure coming from a unit imaginary octonion, meaning both the splitting and the complex structure on the orthogonal space, the complementary space, and also preserve a copy of H2O and H3 of O. So what that means is that these symmetries are acting simultaneously as symmetries of a number of things. They start out acting as symmetries of an octonionic Q-trit, but they're preserving this copy of H2O and H3O, so they're also acting as symmetries of an octonionic qubit. But then we also are picking out this copy of the complex Q-trit in the octonionic Q-trit, thanks to this item one here. So it's also acting on H3C, and it's also acting on H2C, which is the intersection of these two guys here. So that's intriguing. Maybe this is all just a coincidence. Of course, it'd be nice if this actually led to something. I'll just conclude by saying that Lee.
No, so conclude, and then I have a question.
Okay, so there are a bunch of problems. So here what I've been doing is I've been describing the standard model gauge group, but you would also want to know what about its representation on fermions. That's one. And you might hope that since this we've got this octonionic Q-trit idea running around in our description of the standard model gauge group, that maybe that octonionic Q-trit should be there in the standard model. But it's not clear how that is working. It's not even completely clear what we mean by an octonionic Q-trit in the following sense. We have this nice Jordan algebra, H3 of O. That's the observables of the octonionic Q-trit. There's no doubt about that. It does act as operators on O cubed, just by matrix multiplication in some funny way, not associatively. But the symmetry group of H3O doesn't act on O3. It only acts on H3O and also on OP2, which are the pure states. So there's something funny about this O cubed way of thinking about things. If the octonionic qubit would be less mysterious, the standard model gauge group sitting inside spin 9, it also acts on H2O. So it's also acting on the octonionic qubit. And there you can show that it's actually does act in a nice way on O squared via the spinner representation of spin 9. And it makes sense to call that an octonionic qubit, an element of O2 is like a Hilbert space description of the octonionic qubit. And it turns out that thanks to Curiel's work, there's a very beautiful description of the standard model gauge group as being exactly the subgroup of spin 9 whose action on O squared commutes with right multiplication by a chosen unit imaginary octonion. So that's all very nice. But then if you work out how it's acting on O2 with this complex structure, it's acting just as it does on the left-handed fermions in one generation. The right-handed fermions are not there. So there's a big mystery left as to whether the stuff I've discussed can be fleshed out to give some description of the fermions in the standard model in terms of octonionic mathematics, or in terms of this kind of octonionic mathematics anyway. There's other kinds of octonionic mathematics you can use, of course. So I'll end there.
Great, let's thank John. And Lee, you had a question.
Yes, John, this is a big question, but I'm sure you've thought about it. At this point, what I would want to do if I was playing this game to see if this amounted to anything is invent some geometry, not representation theory. So is there any sense of how you could take this version of the labeling of the group and construct a flat connection or any kind of connection acting on some 3+1 dimensional manifold? And can we start to give dynamics to these objects rather than just investigating the representation theoretic structure?
I haven't thought about that a lot. So I don't have anything great to say about that, except that we do have this copy of Minkowski space-time staring us in the face in this picture, which is H2C, and we do have the standard model gauge group running around. So it should be pretty easy to build a trivial bundle with that gauge group over that Minkowski space-time. But I haven't tried to, for example, like write down a Lagrange, like a gauge field, Yang-Mills Lagrangian.
Or even a topological field theory. Just write down df equals zero and see if anything.
Yeah, no, I haven't tried any of those things. I spent the last couple of weeks while I was preparing this talk trying to get the math of that I just described all cleared up in my mind. So that's all I've got.
John, it's a great thing. It's a wonderful talk.
Thanks.
Very few of us could have done that.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I should say that this it's there in Dubois, Violette, and Todorov's paper, and also in Curiel's paper. But being a mathematician, I've been trying to squeeze it down to some kind of theorem, and trying to maybe hint, which might hint at some kind of conceptual meaning of what's going on, or gives people some inspiration for what to do with this. And so, okay. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do.
Could I make a comment and a question? I couldn't find the appropriate button to push on here.
Sure.
Oh, am I?
You're okay.
Go ahead.
Am I heard?
Yes.
Yeah, we hear you. We hear you.
Good. Yeah, very nice talk, John. I just wanted to comment just about it's to do with the choice of unit imaginary. Why should one pick out a unit imaginary octonion? Now, earlier on in your talk, when you were mentioning this, the distinction between multiplying by I to get, you can, if you're in the over the complex numbers, then if you have a Hermitian matrix, you multiply it by I and you get an anti-Hermitian one, which you can use as a symmetry generator. Uh-huh. Now, the thing is that, and you were saying, well, that picks out the Jordan algebras over complex numbers as special. But there are two points here, is that you can do something like that for the other Jordan algebras, but then you're going to need, instead of having a single observable which generates a symmetry, you need a pair of them. And so then the operation is the associator rather than the commutator. So if you, let me put it another way. If you look, and this is perhaps the main point I wanted to say, was that if you look at the Heisenberg equation of motion, then normally you have to introduce an I. So that's often the way that one explains why do you need to introduce the complex numbers in quantum mechanics? Well, because if you want a Hamiltonian to generate a motion in time, you're going to have to introduce a factor of I. So I just wondered. But there's another way of doing that. So essentially you're picking out a direction of time because you could have I or minus I.
Right.
I mean, there's another way of doing that. So if you have that Heisenberg equation of motion, you can actually rewrite it as if your Hamiltonian can be written as the commutator of two other Hermitian matrices, then in fact you can rewrite that Heisenberg equation of motion in terms of an associator with your other two observables. And then of course that doesn't pick out any direction of time. So that will actually work for all the other cases as well, but it won't pick out-
Is that an associator for the Jordan product?
Yeah, so in other words, if you're interested in the question, how do I generate a time? You've got your observables and your states, but what about the time evolution?
Okay.
So, okay, in the complex case, that's easy. Heisenberg equation of motion.
There's
an analogous equation of motion that applies in the other cases, but it doesn't pick out a direction of time, doesn't pick out a direction. So I'm just wondering if in the case when we start applying this to the standard model, if the motivation for picking out a unit imaginary octonion has to do somehow with essentially cosmology. I mean, picking out a direction of time. Those are two slightly disconnected points, but maybe they are related in some way.
Yeah, thanks. I think I actually have studied how you get those derivations of Jordan algebras from associators, but I somehow hadn't connected it back to the physics side of my brain. And so it will be good for me to think about that here.
I can mention there's a review of Jordan algebras years ago I wrote, and I put up more recently, a few years ago, I put up a transcript of it on the archive. And I thought there was one point in it that I thought was original, which was to do with something with what I was just telling you. But actually, then later, I actually discovered it's in the paper. It's in a paper of Nambu many years ago. It's when he introduces Nambu mechanics, and he starts looking for, at some point, he starts to consider Jordan algebra as an associate. And in fact, it's this, the same thing is actually in his paper.
Ah, that's interesting. Well, then maybe I'll finally understand Nambu mechanics.
So, it's stated in the in this review thing that I wrote. It's on the archive, but actually, the original. I didn't know that, but in fact, I found it later. It's in Nambu's paper.
Oh, that's neat. Thanks. I'll look at that. Maybe Kirill or Lee.
Love to. John, I had two questions. One is that few slides back, you had a SU3 cross SU3. One of the SU3s you identified with a strong interaction. Can the other one be SU3 flavor? This is one. Okay, so first you can answer this, then I come to my next question.
Yeah, well, everyone is tempted to relate the, did you say flavor? Or your generation.
Generations.
I mean, everyone is tempted when they see the exceptional Jordan algebra to think it has something to do with the three generations. I haven't managed to find a way to make that really work. In this particular case, the other both of these SU3s, the standard model gauge group is sitting inside this SU3 times SU3. And one of them is giving you the strong force SU3. And the other SU3 you should think of as maybe like some kind of primordial SU3 that contains the U1 times SU2. So you can imagine some breaking scenario where the electroweak force was once upon a time its own SU3. But it has nothing visible to do with like the three generations and all.
So the related question is, what if you go to complexified H3O, where the group is E6? Okay, what's the difficulty if you try to represent three fermion generations using that?
I don't know what the difficulty is with that. Sorry, I can't. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I haven't tried it hard enough to find an obstacle.
There
are other interesting things to say about complexifying this H3O and bringing E6 into the picture. Latham was raising that issue in some emails recently, because it might deal with what I consider the very pressing problem that that right now, if we try to use this octonionic description to understand the fermions, it's rather easy to get the left-handed fermions into the game, but the right-handed fermions aren't so easily showing up in this description.
Yeah, just quickly to say, I discussed that a little bit. That's discussed a little bit in a paper that I posted this past summer, and I'll talk about that a little bit more in my talk later in the workshop. It's the answer is a little bit involved.
Great. Yeah, I'd like to think more about that.
Thank you.
Sure. Yep. Ben?
Hi there. I'm Ben. I'm in Canada, Saskatchewan. Thanks very much for your talk. What I wanted to ask about was, if you look at this idea of selecting an imaginary unit in the octonions in the context of a Jordan algebra, because you can say that in one sentence, and because we're familiar with constructing Jordan algebras as matrices over octonions, for instance, but the group F4, it has a lot of symmetry. And if we can select any three orthogonal, I think you call them pure states, then we can split this 27 dimensional algebra into 1+1+1 plus 8+8+8. And we have to go further to specify octonion structure. And only then can we say, let's select an imaginary unit. And what's interesting to me is that after selecting that imaginary unit, we're going to relax that previous constraints that we put on there, because the standard model is not inside of G2 and it's not inside of D4. So I wonder if looking at Jordan algebras more directly and seeing the Octonians as downstream of the exceptional Jordan algebra might give us a new way to sort of state your two sentence answer to where does the standard model come from.
Yeah, that sounds nice to me because that sounds like a math problem. it sounds like a problem that should have some solution. I haven't thought about that enough, so maybe we could talk about that sometime. So the way I would like to try to go about that would be to start out just thinking of H3 of O as a Jordan algebra. And you're right, not acting like you don't know it's 3x3 matrices of Octonians. Just think of it as sort of an anonymous Jordan algebra, and then figure out what extra structure you have to slap on that Jordan algebra to break the symmetry group down to the standard model gauge group, but phrased purely in the Jordan algebra language. Yeah. I don't know how to do that, but that sounds like a fairly well-posed math problem. I mean, it could have lots of answers, but should have a good answer. Do you have an idea?
I have an idea. I think that the first step would be to say, we've got a Jordan algebra, and so we've got a manifold of primitive inipotents, which are your pure states that you mentioned. Yep. That's the Octonian projective plane. So if you select any point in the Octonian projective plane, that's the same thing as selecting an H2O subalgebra, because that's just the vectors that are orthogonal to it relative to this trace. And then the next step, which is the tricky one, which I have played with, but I'm not sure how it works, is realizing that H2O, it's got the 8-sphere, like you said, but these primitive inipotents, they actually have a Riemann manifold structure. So they have geodesic curves. Mm-hmm. And I speculate that if you just select any geodesic curve on this 8-sphere, that might be enough to get you quite close to the standard model. So it would be select a primitive inipotent and then select a geodesic curve on the 8-sphere. I think that might be enough, or it'll get you close, I think.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's nice. Yeah, I definitely completely agree with picking the primitive inipotent or pure state. At one point in my talk, I was describing things when I was trying to write this talk. I was describing things that way instead of picking out a copy of H2O. But those are completely equivalent. So then it seems to me you need to get down to getting yourself a copy of H2C in there, but then, well, at least in the description that I'm talking about in my talk, we need a bit more than that. There's a little bit of extra structure that's being preserved by the standard model gauge group. Anyway, thanks. That's a good thing to think about. I think Namrata has had her hand up for a while.
Hi, thank you. Hi. It was a wonderful talk, and I was able to follow through. So thank you so much. So my question actually kind of ties in with the previous question from the person from Saskatchewan, it's similar. Like when you were talking about, the cones, where you have the determinant equals zero, and then you have the states, and you had the pure states in blue, which you would call, let's say, boundary states.
Yeah, the right word for that would be extreme points. So those, there's certain. I mean, in this case, it's the whole boundary, but in general, for the Jordan algebra, the pure states are what you call the extreme points of the states. Anyway, we could get into that if we cared, but go ahead. Yeah.
Right. So basically, I guess my first thing would be we would have to describe such extreme points. But I guess the question is, like, can we use these Jordan algebras to describe the Minkowski space with these pure states on the boundary? And basically where I'm going is to have this, like, to be able to describe this manifold between two different let's say, not boundaries per se, but whatever field you're looking at, two different gauge fields. We can always use a path integral or some other way to connect them to actually describe the relationship between, like, the boundary and, let's say, the bulk, for example. So can we use Jordan algebras to do that? Like, how close is it to Minkowski space that we can actually use that?
I don't really know a good answer to that, but I mean, I will just say that, I mean, everything about Minkowski space-time is available in this Jordan algebra framework for spin factors. Like, the problem, in a sense, is that even more than what you want is available, because what the spin factor is really describing is not exactly Minkowski space-time, but it's actually Minkowski space-time with a chosen time axis. So that's why these symmetries get to be not the Lorentz group, but a smaller group, which is like O, I guess in this case would be like O and. So you have the sort of both the benefits of Minkowski space-time and Euclidean space-time. But by the way, if you throw out some aspects of the Jordan algebra and only keep track of the determinant, then the symmetries that preserve that are just going to be the Lorentz group. And so you should do that.
Okay.
So I'm not completely answering your question, but I guess I'm saying that, in fact, the Jordan algebra structure is sort of more structure than you need to describe Minkowski spacetime.
Right. One of the reasons I had asked that, like, I don't know if anyone's done this, but it makes sense. Like, just because, like, you just said that the spin factors have a lot more information, so to speak, like structural information than, let's say, just the Lorentz group. So it would give you more of an idea of what said boundary would look like. Or, like, you know, what other structures may arise, especially if you're doing something in terms of quantum gravity, so to speak. I know I'm speaking in generalities because I haven't done this either.
I don't have anything terribly good. I don't have anything terribly good to say about that.
I guess, could you describe what you meant by when you said the pure states would be, like, critical? Special states, like critical ones?
They're called extreme points.
So
the
idea
is that I'll point my hand at this picture, but you should somehow be imagining a general Jordan algebra. Or maybe I should not get rid of the picture here. So there's this cone of non-negative elements, and then the ones whose trace is one, they're called states. And that set of states is what's called a convex set. Meaning that you can, if you draw a straight line between any two states, any point along that interval between them will again be a state. So convex linear combinations of states are states. And whenever you have a convex set, there's a concept of extreme point. So an extreme point in a convex set is one that's not lying on one of these line segments between any other points in the convex set. So, like, if my convex set was a ball, the points on the surface of the ball would be extreme points, because if I take two points on the ball and draw a straight line between them, the points on that straight line, in the middle of the straight line, couldn't be on the surface of the ball. So the points on the surface of a ball are extreme points because they don't lie on any line joining any other two points. But extreme point is a more specialized concept than the boundary, because, for example, if I take a cube is a convex set, but the points on the faces of the cube in the middle of a square are not extreme points, because a point on the face of a cube could be gotten by drawing a line between two other points on the face of the cube and picking a point along that line. So for a cube, only the edges of the cube and the corners are the extreme points. Okay. So it's actually quite tricky to visualize this kind of thing. It's very easy to visualize the states in this kind of example when they're a ball, and then the pure states, the extreme points are a sphere. But I've had a lot of trouble visualizing these other examples. So that what we're saying here is, like, for the case like n equals 3, so we're saying that CP2, which is a pretty interesting four-dimensional manifold, not at all a sphere. CP2 you can think of as the extreme points of a convex set of the density matrices. So the states in this case are density matrices. So I'm saying you take density matrices, 3x3 self-adjoint matrices with trace 1, look at the extreme points of that, and you get CP2. So that's an example of how these extreme points work.
Thank you. I think this makes even this, for some reason, that makes even more sense now, because if you are looking at a Minkowski spacetime, a curved Minkowski spacetime, then it makes sense. You start with the, you know, n equals 2, and then you can, like, go forward. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to look into this.
Yeah. Okay. Michelle?
Yes. Thank you for your lecture, which was very clear. I have no real question. I have some remark on some question we have been posed. So first, the origin of my work was I was working from a lot of time to add a piece of quantum space to space-time to make the theory of fundamental particle, because I think it is a phenomenon of quantum theory. And a lot of things are quite well, but at some moment, around 10 years ago, I was wondering what is the meaning of the unimodularity of SU3, a scalar group. It is absolutely not natural, because if we say that the quark has three color, or okay, a Hilbert space has three dimensions, the group should be U3, okay? Doing that, I say, okay, this means that there is a complex volume down, so a trilinear form. Uh-huh. So since we are in three dimensions, one always can do transform this in a product, like the vector product in R. So you take your volume and you say volume of x, y, z is the scalar product of the new product of x and y with z. And like that, you obtain an antisymmetric antilinear product on C3, okay?
Right, yes.
And now SU3 is exactly the group which preserves these two things.
Yes.
Uh-huh. So now, if you have the curiosity to compute the norm of the product, the norm square of the product, this new product, you find that it is the product of the norm square, okay, of the two factors, minus the norm square of the scalar product of these two factors. So you see, this say you that if I had a factor C, and if I say that I have a projection of C on C on C of C3 on C plus C3, okay, I can say that if I take a projection of this product, the scalar product on the factor C and the product before, then this product would be isometric, okay? Mm-hmm. So now the natural thing to do when you are in this situation is to add a unit which corresponds to the factor C that you have here, and to say, okay, I have a product on C3 plus C, okay, which is such that if I take the factor two elements of the C3 and if I take the other product, the projection on C3 is the product I have already, and the projection onto the unit is a scalar product. So once you see that, you say you should try to extend this product as an isometric product from C3 plus C on itself, okay? Which is a, and there are not so much, this depend of some phase, but it's essentially unique, and it's lead to a product, which is C3 is exactly the group which act linearly on C3 and which preserves this product. This product, of course, is not bilinear complex, and since for two reasons. First, the internal product is, as I say, antilinear in the two factor, and second is this sesquilinear on the projection on the product. But what you see when you do that is that, looking a little, this, you obtain like that a division algebra.
Yes.
Since this product is not still linear, okay, it's a product on R8, okay?
Right, yeah.
Which is a division algebra, so you have not, and which is isometric, okay? We have not the choice, it's necessarily the octonion. But of course, it is the octonion realized by a linear complex action on the factor C3. This is why this select inside the octonion, this C3 and this action. And you must not forget this action, because this action is really the color group which act linearly, okay, on the component of the quark. So now, when you see that,
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've had a very long discussion already. So can you try to make your question precise?
Okay, I have no question. I have just the remark. I say that first, so this is my first remark, that it is completely natural to do the thing like that and to interpret then the factor C as the lepton associated to the quark, because it's, of course, a trivial representation aussi. My second point is the following. The difficulty to work with the exceptional algebra is that all Jordan modules on this exceptional algebra are a factor of this exceptional algebra. The only irreductible module is the exceptional algebra itself. So all what you can do is tensorize with some vector space redundant itself. And if you try to make the particle there, you can, but you will have some more particle. So this is the second point. The third point is that if you look at the 2x2 octonionic matrix, you can look at, you are right, the automorphism group of this is onus, since it's a factor, the spin factor 9, okay? But if you look at the subgroup, which preserve this splitting in C plus C3 acting linear, which act linearly on C, you find that it is the connected part of this is O3 cross U3. Okay? So as you remark, this is not exactly the standard group, because there is a factor Z2 there. But this factor Z2 is easy to understand with your analysis, because it corresponds to the fact that when you see that inside the exceptional algebra, you have two spinners over there. Okay? And you see, when you pass from space-time to the spinner field, of course, you take a covering of... what I mean is that this means that the torsion part of the fundamental group of the group is not some obstruction, you see?
Okay, well, we can... Yeah,
it's not obstruction at all to make a module over there which contain all the information of the particle of the standard model for one generation. So this is all what I want to...
I'll have to think about the last part, especially. So the first part, it's something that I invented and then discovered that it's in Yokota's lectures on exceptional groups, which is, well, I explained it in this blog article, and I'm not going to go over it, but the idea is that, like you said, if you pick a complex inner product and a complex volume form on C3, then you can define a kind of cross product on C3, which is conjugate linear, which is why I'm writing this overline here. But then if you copy the usual formula for how to build the quaternions out of R plus R3, you get a formula for the octonions, yes, which is very beautiful. And then you see this way that the subgroup of G2 that preserves a unit imaginary octonion has got to be SU3, because SU3 is exactly what's preserving the inner product and the volume form on C3. So yes, it seems very, people have thought about this in different ways for a while, but it's very tempting to think that the strong force is connected to all of that nice mathematics.
Okay, we have 40 minutes past the end of the discussion. So I think we should wrap up. So let's thank John again.
Great, thanks very much.